session number 18467, Reel 3.
Griffith, Reel 3.
When we weren't organizing the defense of the railway line, which was run, incidentally, by the Americans, and the supplies were guarded by the Russians, so it was a triple operation. When we were free, we used to take to the countryside and go off and find interesting rock features to climb. And I found a small group of people who used to come out with me, and we used to go and enjoy ourselves. Local security was not of a worrying kind, and I don't remember any difficulties in getting around safely. We had parties there. The Russians used to come and entertain us. By that time, they were organized with proper concert parties.
Which part of Persia is this?
This was... It was when the railway just began to climb up into the foothills. I think it was Kasr-i-Shirin. I know there were a hell of a lot of tunnels on that bit of the railway line. And it must have been steep because some of the trains had as many as 4 engines on them. I never managed to get further up the line and go and see the capital myself, which I'd love to have done. My recollection of the rest of Persia is rather vague. I had been up there at least twice before, going by road. And I remember always enjoying it a great deal, because it is a lovely country to travel through, although the people were desperately poor.
Did you have much contact with the Guards infantry in Persia?
Oh yes, I was camped right next door to them. I lived all practically cheek by jowl with them. But I didn't actually operate with them, because my job again was seeing that brigade headquarters ran properly.
Had they changed much since the 30s?
They changed a little bit, yes. They had become a bit more formal. They hadn't got this wonderful freedom from regimentation.
What then happened to you?
Well, then, I think I must have gone with the guides down nearer Iraq on the Persian border, because the next thing I remember was being in a very loose, open camp and being left in command. Because my CO, who was by that time a chap called Bailey was long overdue his home leave, and the regiment was going to go through a fairly uneventful training period, and so they could safely entrust it to a chap like me, I suppose. And I had a wonderful time. I had a second in command, a fellow called Chisholm, Wallace Chisholm, who, if he's alive still, God bless him, was a marvellous chap to have as a second in command, because I was given free rein, or I took free rein, of the training of this regiment. I'd spent a lot of time thinking about training soldiers. And my whole attitude towards training ordinary soldiers is, I think, very much as is taken from what little I know now of the army, whereby soldiers, individual soldiers, are taught to think for themselves. Not to wait for instruction. Anyway, Wallace Chisholm and I organized this battalion's training in such a way that a company would go out into a camp, a training camp, and would go through a program of very intensive, highly imaginative training. From which they would come back, and then when they were back around the battalion headquarters, they would go through an equally intensive period of individual training. And this again was taught in a way slightly different from normal. That's the only parade ground where I can remember listening to soldiers coming off parade and chattering about what they had been doing on that particular parade ground with enjoyment.
This is the Guards Infantry, is it?
This is the Guards Infantry, yes.
Were you the colonel of the regiment by then?
No, I was only a major. I put a lot of my outlook to a certain chap called Fattus Taylor, who had taught me what little I knew about work with the scouts. That's a totally different subject, which I could talk about if you want me to. The scouts are a frontier militia serving on the Northwest frontier. And their job is that of policing the interborder area and seeing that the local tribespeople behave themselves and that such law as there is obeyed. Do you want me to digress and talk about them now?
Yes.
Well, the scouts, when they operate, to start with, they are very, very lightly armed. They carry a rifle and one or two bandoliers of small arms. Of ammunition. They, long before the regular army, used portable wireless sets. And by that I mean highly portable wireless sets, which in those years the army hadn't cottoned on to at all. Uh, As a footnote, those portable wireless sets were designed, I think I'm right in saying, by a certain man called Pepin, who was the signals officer of the OTC of Marlborough College. He was a naval officer. And we found out about these things, and one man could carry this portable thing. You could use them on speech, but we trained people to use them on Morse. Because Morse can get through atmospherics in a way that speech very often cannot. Well, anyway, I trained the guides to use these sets. And I'm getting muddled in by what I'm saying now. When I was with the scouts, we were taught to, shall I say, flow through the countryside. We were taught a very, very fluid type of operation, whereby the officer commanding the column would move through the country in a given direction, and the troops would more or less flow around him. You would have two groups of troops ahead of him. And if the group right up in front saw a certain feature that dominated the route you were going to take, he would go and take that feature without instructions. And then the next group would flow up into his position, and then from behind another group would come up and take that position. So you see, there was a sort of circular motion like this the whole time going on. All of it, or most of it, without any instruction at all.
This is the scouts.
This was with the scouts. Well, I adapted a certain amount of this to the guides and began to teach them how to move in a similar fashion. They didn't all like it. I remember some young officers coming back, not liking this kind of having to use their own initiative, because you interfered with them as little as possible. As long as the chap was doing his job properly, you encouraged him. And then, of course, as you went along, the picket would guard your way through, and then as soon as you had moved a certain distance, he would fall in behind you, and then come up, and then repeat the flow. It was all very basic, but it was a very efficient way, and you could carry out an operation and cover 30 miles in the day without any problem at all. You could go double the speed that you could do with ordinary, shall I say, standard infantry marching. Anyway, I got the guides into this, and they adapted to it, you see, because again, half of them were frontiersmen. They were used to flowing over the countryside and used to using their initiative over the ground.
When had you had your experience with the scouts?
I had that during a period after I had been in Rusmuk with the guides.
So you were attached temporarily to the scouts?
Yes. You used to do a 3-year attachment, normally.
And you were under a man called Fatters Taylor?
No, he had been in the scouts before. It was rather a tradition in the guides that you went and did a period with the scouts. And he had taught this to me when I served with him in the guides, but he had before me served in the scouts. And I used it when I went and joined the scouts.
So some of the guides' officers came to you because they wanted more direction, did they?
Some of them did, yes.
What did you say to them?
You used to encourage them to use their wits and think for themselves. Now, what would you do if you were gone here and you had to guard a column here? What features would you take? What would you do about it? Don't wait for me to tell you. Get on with it. I'll pull you back quick enough if you're making a mistake.
But this was in Persia, on the
This
frontier
was
with
in Persia.
Iraq.
This was in Persia that I'm coming back to now, because while we were training the battalion in this rather more fluid way, which we developed to what I think was quite a reasonable degree, the commanding officer had his leave and then came back and found this slightly changed battalion. And I had organized, in fact, a battalion march through a bit of countryside just as a training exercise. And I told him what I had done. He said, "Well, carry on. I'll come along with you and watch." And he didn't say anything. He didn't say anything one way or the other. But I don't think they carried on with that way of doing things for long. I think he went back to his old traditional way of doing things pretty soon, because I must have left the regiment fairly soon after that.
To
I
do.
can't remember whether that was when I was due home leave or what. Because I know I had done about 7 years out there then, and I was certainly due to go home on leave soonish, and this was during the war. And from leave home, I went out to Calcutta and then on further east.
To do what?
Second in command of a battalion of frontier force.
Which battalion was
Now
that?
I'm trying to think. It was either the 8th or the 9th. I've forgotten which came first. I think it was the 8th. And I joined them just about the time of the breakout from the Pegu-Yomas.
Was 1945.
Yes. And I hadn't been with them very long when my old friend Gunga Hayudin heard that I was out there and applied to have me transferred to his battalion. And I joined him only a matter of weeks before his advance party was given sudden orders, I think at 3 days' notice, to fly an advance party to Saigon. And we flew three Dakota loads of us.
Had you seen any fighting in Burma?
Yes, a little bit.
What did it
A little bit.
consist of?
It was again mostly light arms. We were following up these retreating Japanese. And by that time, the 8th were a bit blasé, as a matter of fact. You know, they didn't bother to take cover at night or anything like that. They had the Japs on the run and their tails were right up. I did get more experience of organizing gunfire on enemy troops, which was instructive, very useful for me. And by God, those gunners were good.
So this was the Frontier Force Rifles?
Yes. And they were 9th also, Frontier Force Rifles.
How did you find them after the Guards Infantry?
Very similar. They recruited from similar areas. Their outlook was very much the same. Mind you, in those days, of course, you had very few regular officers in a regiment. I suppose we had perhaps three. All the rest were wartime officers who had come from different walks of life. And we were very lucky in the officers we had. We had very good types. In Saigon, we were posted to what had been a, I don't know if it had been a monastery or what, but it was a kind of little fort on the outskirts of Saigon. And I was put in charge of the local Japs who were guarding the airfield. The French had not come back by the, at that time.
What was the demeanor of the Japanese?
Very helpful initially. In fact, at one period, some of them came under my command and operated under me. And I was delighted to see that they were just as frightened of rifle fire as any other troops I had seen. And it was during that period that the riot, the local riots, broke out. And the locals broke out against the Japs and such few French as were left there, started to take over possession of the airfield and deny anyone access to it. And I had to go furiously to Japanese headquarters to demand an escort to take me, to escort me through to the airfield, because I wanted to meet somebody there. And that was nasty for a time, but nobody really did anything serious to stop us.
So and then it was local Vietnamese nationalists or
that's right,
communists?
Yes. They were local Vietnamese nationalists. They hadn't really sort of given themselves titles by that time. They simply seized a lot of weapons and were charging around the place, ordering people about.
What contact with them did you have?
Damn all. Except on bridges and places like that where I was trying to get through. When I had to get the Japanese then to deal with the local Vietnamese commander. I'm glad to say I didn't have anything to do with it.
So what was the Vietnamese...
We had no common language except perhaps French.
What was the Vietnamese attitude towards you as a British officer in uniform?
Not understanding. Couldn't think what this chap was being so crazy about. I hadn't got any of my own troops with me.
Was there any shooting between the Vietnamese and the Japanese?
I don't record any. I can't remember any. Not where I was. Through my whole military life, I've had a sort of charmed experience. The people seem to put their weapons away. It was the same in the scouts. I come back to an amusing incident in the Scouts when you want me to. On those lines, but soon I and the battalion were sent down to Cap Saint-Jacques, which was at the mouth of the estuary.
This is the 9th Frontier Force Rifles.
Yes. And we got on very well with the local people there. Some of them, in fact, had married from French men were married to local Vietnamese wives. So it was a fairly mixed community, very informal. And we led an idyllic peacetime life of soldiery. In fact, when the Japanese produced a couple of trawlers to go out and fish, I went out with them and had a wonderful day fishing those local seas. Because the Japs, you see, by then were told that the French were coming and that if they didn't very quickly start organizing a means of feeding themselves, that they would become very hungry. Because the French were not very good at administration. By this time, the Japs were beginning to collect down to the hinterland behind Cap Saint-Jacques, where they were told to start growing vegetables, grow any poultry they could, do anything to organize their own commissariat, because the Japs had very few sea-going cargo boats at that time. They could no longer demand food of the locals at will, and were going to be self-dependent. The first signs of the French happened actually in Saigon, because the first thing I knew of them was they're sending a column down past my little fort out into the countryside and shooting each side of the road as they went. And this made me furious, because I'd had no shooting in that area. So I stopped the column and told the commander that he must put his weapons away, and I said, I will see you escorted through this area in future. Let me know when you want to go through, and I'll see that you get through safely. And I have a vivid picture. I had an adjutant, Tim Finnis, who was known as the Chinless Wonder. He had one of these faces with no chin to it at all, a big forehead, an enormous sense of humor. And he was a good soldier, actually. But to see him sitting up very straight, driving a Land Rover with one sepoy beside him,